lot of overtime on this bill anyway, so anyway.
But I would like to go on. We have three more people to testify, and at this time, I'd like to hear from Chris Stevens in Anchorage, please.
This is Chris Stevens. I'm the president of the Bond Stevens & Johnson, which is a commercial real estate brokerage firm in Anchorage. I was here Friday. You asked me to testify at that time on the commercial endorsement, and I don't know if I need to go through all that again, but I simply say that I support it very strongly. I think the need for it is abundantly clear to those involved in the industry, and with all due respect to the gentleman who spoke earlier and to others, the education requirements are certainly not burdensome, and to take some additional education to gain expertise in an area which you're going to practice, I think is not unreasonable. I think it's necessary for the protection of the public. I would like to point out that the National Association of Realtor courses, at least the commercial ones that I'm familiar with, you do not have to be a member of the National Association of Realtors. Anybody can take them. I think there's a little different fee structure for non-members, but no one is excluded from taking those courses. On this section 37 has been batted around, I want to point out one thing. I think it highlights the difference between commercial, perhaps, and residential. But on line, starting on line 23 and going on to 24, it's talking about getting this personal services contract signed before you can do anything. Well, anyone who's done very much commercial real estate at all learns very, very quickly that many companies would never sign such a thing. The person who you would be dealing with, some real estate official with a corporation, they're going to ship any document like that off to their legal department to be signed, and you'll never see it again. So in the commercial sector, that type of thing, I just don't think it's practical, as well-meaning as it is. So I just point that out. One thing that you did do in the amendment, I think it makes a lot of sense on the leasing of commercial property. The way the bill was originally drafted, I understand you had to have a property management endorsement to lease commercial property, which really doesn't make any sense. I would dare say that in Anchorage, in any way, at least 90% of the leasing, commercial leasing that is done in Anchorage is done by brokers, not by property managers. Certainly property managers do some, but the vast bulk of it is done by commercial brokers. So it doesn't make sense to have a commercial broker take a property manager endorsement to do what you've been doing for a long time anyway. So I applaud that. On your definition of commercial, I think that when you put a dollar amount on it, I have two concerns. One is over time with inflation, the dollar amount doesn't mean what it meant when you wrote it. And the other thing is, for those who do not have a commercial endorsement, there's going to be a strong economic incentive to make sure that that transaction is below $500,000, which gives an incentive that you don't want to be there. So perhaps instead, and I just made this up, so I'm certainly, there's no pride of authorship here, but maybe something you might want to consider, is on your second line with the sale transactions of, replace all that and say something to the effect the sale or lease of single family houses and rental units up to four units and unimproved single family lots. And that was just an attempt to try to define what residential is really all about versus what commercial is all about, and perhaps try and stay away from the dollar definition. That's all I have to say.
Very good, Mr. Stevens. Are there questions of Mr. Stevens? Mr. Stevens, this is the chairman. One thing I wanted to point out, and I'd like to have some further feedback on, is the way that I conceive of drafting the commercial endorsement is that the property management endorsee would be able to let premises for above the $500,000 mark if they were a duly endorsed property manager, but I think that's right. It's not, you know, I did want to make it, I wanted to set it up so a property manager could do the leasing and renting as set forth in the bill, but also a commercial endorsee could do it also. And so there wouldn't be a necessity to have joint or multiple endorsements. In other words, a commercial endorsee could participate in renting and leasing a property without having a property management endorsement. And that's the way I conceive setting it up. But the issue then becomes, and I haven't, would be whether a property management endorsee could lease something that would have a value in excess of $500,000, say a gross aggregate of rental receipts. But then that's, and you're correct when you get into the area of trying to limit the definition by an amount, which I think if we do retain that would be have to be CPI underwritten. But I find it somewhat problematic, and without going into massive definitions, not putting value on that distinction. So, and if in fact, and I appreciate we're opening this thing up, and I would like to have the input of the entire real estate community on trying to come up with an acceptable definition that will get the job done without creating a burden on anybody. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, I think that I agree with you. I think the property managers on the commercial side, they do commercial leasing, and that should be part of the property management endorsement on the commercial side, and I think the brokers do too. How you sort that out within the bill, I don't know, but I agree with you. Just one comment. In my experience, real estate values do not necessarily follow the CPI, so hooking the dollar amount in the bill to the CPI may not achieve what we're trying to achieve either.
Well, I appreciate that. We may have to have a periodic review.
Yeah.
And very good. Any further questions, Mr. Stevens? Well, thank you very much, Chris, for coming out again. Now, this time I'd like to go to Christine Tanner and then Grace Oakley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Kristen Tanner, and I am from the Matsu Valley, and I'm currently a licensee holding the CCIM designation, which is the same designation that the previous speaker, Chris Stephen, holds. The 2 points I wanted to point out today is that the task force agreed with Representative Cowdery and Representative Ryan that there were definitely situations that needed to be accepted from the current law, because currently in statute there is not a remedy or an exception for the mother-in-law who gets sick and goes out of state. And so our desire was to create a number of exceptions in which, I think if you read through the list, which starts on page 29, 30, 32, and 33, goes through a number of different exceptions that if you think through them, with the exception of maybe deciding how many can be done under a power of attorney, really try to broaden it to include more or fewer units, to include powers of attorney, to include people that are acting under the authority of a will or trust, as a receiver, a trustee, administrator, executor, under a court order, in their official duties. We have a number of different exceptions in this statute that currently are, some of them are currently available and some of them aren't. We truly tried to expand it because we agreed that there were different times when the law obviously created a situation where somebody was in violation, and truly that was not the spirit of the people that were participating in a specific transaction. So I think if you can refer and review all those exceptions, I think you'll find that the majority of concerns will fall within one of those exceptions. With that one exception I just pointed out, that the power of attorney needs to be expanded to a different number. But that was at least our attempt at trying to expand it to cover those issues that were brought up. The other point I wanted to bring up is, if you have any questions regarding the number of endorsements and how the requirements for education and the number of continuing hours, how those would cross over, I'd be happy to answer those questions.
Very good, Christine. Does that conclude your testimony?
Yes, it does.
And for the record, I'd like to point out that Ms. Tanner did submit written testimony that was received by the committee today, and we really appreciate that, Kristen. And I have got a couple of questions, but Representative Ryan has a question.
Yes, Ms. Tanner, I am interested primarily in what achieving the benefits that are possible by the continuing education without having to perhaps spend 3 or 4 weeks or 5 weeks and considerable sums going through a gauntlet to, in the next couple of years, to get the endorsements for all of the things that were going to be required before people who are presently engaged lose their grandfather position and have to go through this testing thing. Do you have any concept of what period of time and what expense will be involved for a person to accomplish this?
Sure. The idea behind the task force is that the 12 hours of continuing education, for instance, if you wanted your sales endorsement and your property management endorsement, rather than having to get 20 hours for each of them, you would have to get 8 hours of the core requirements for each of those endorsements, which total 16, and pick up 4 more for continuing education. So the point is that you could use, under the salesman, you're currently required to get 8 hours of core classes and 12 hours of continuing education. You could use 8 of those 12 hours to get another core endorsement so that you wouldn't have to be taking 40 hours, but instead, for instance, to get 2 endorsements, you would have to take
16 hours of core.
16 hours of core plus another 4. So you wouldn't be taking any additional hours at all, but you would just be taking very segmented courses. 8 hours of core for sales, 8 hours of core for property management, and then 4 of elective. So if you wanted a third endorsement, you would use those 4 additional elective continuing education hours and then just pick up 4 more. So to get 3 endorsements, you would need 24 hours, and currently to get the 1 endorsement, you would need 20. So we tried to design it in such a way that it wouldn't be overly burdensome to obtain the number of hours required by law, nor financially, make it financially not possible either.
Well, thank you very much. That sounds rather well thought out.
Ms. Tanner, as long as we're on this subject right now, could you indicate that there are draft regulations about the continuing education? Are you aware of those, and were you involved in any of those?
Draft regulations? Separate from this bill?
Yeah.
Briefly, I was not involved with them.
Okay, I'll have Ms. Pope ask about that. Also, could you, for the record, explain what the CCIM, define that, not explain what it is, just give us the definition of it.
It's Certified Commercial Investment Member.
Thank you, and also, in regard to the exceptions and the committee's look at it, there's an existing area of the law that's creating the committees and the staff some vexion right now, and it refers to, and I'll refer to you to page 30, lines 2 and 3. It's in the existing statute now where it refers to unless the transaction involves land defined in, this is the subdivision statute, that is not in Alaska. Do you know, and that's also picked up in the next .900 section, that did the task force consider what that was, and could you explain what that is at all?
Not sure I'm going to explain it very well. Maybe Mr. McNall can, but if you look on page 31, line 17, it's put back in there.
Right.
But Mr. McNall will have to answer specifically what it is if he can.
And let's see. Also, Ms. Tanner, can you tell us that if an individual who is taking a license course for licensure of beginning and also continuing education, is any credit given if the fact they have a degree in economics or business on a baccalaureate basis? Do they get, receive any credit from the Alaska Real Estate Commission for those degrees?
Are you talking about a person obtaining a new license?
Either a new license or any continuing education course.
At this time, if someone wanted to obtain credit for a university class that they have taken, or that they want to take, they have to have it approved by the commission. There's not anything I'm aware of to approve something someone's taken in the past. However, I do agree with your amendment that you put forth today that specifically outlines, and well, I guess it's in the bill,
right.
In your amendment, that outlines that those courses would be available, the real estate courses that can be taken through the university for continuing education.
Right, if they're approved by the commission and the amount of hours granted would be by regulation by the commission, but they specifically provide for credit of those courses, which has been absent to date.
Correct, they have been absent to date.
Very good. Matter of fact, before we go on to Ms. Oakley, is Mr. McNall, are you still available, or did you go?
The section that you're asking questions about,
right,
is related to the Interstate Land Sale Practices Act, which is federal, and controls the area. I don't think we could pass a law that would contradict that area.
Well, I guess there is a definition reference, and it's in the Alaska statute as far as the land sales subdivisions.
I believe that's correct.
And we were curious about the antecedents to it. The best I could come up with was the sales of property, very much like the residential type promotions, the general, General Development Corporation sales of Florida title flats that went on for a number of decades and the like. I think that was probably the antecedents to that, but there has been some concerns expressed that if a person did happen to own out-of-state property and they wanted to subdivide that land, why couldn't they sell that property? So that's the nature of the inquiry. This is in the existing statute.
No, I can't answer beyond what I said, sir.
Very good. Thank you very much.
I think Grace Oakley can probably take it further.
Very good. Are there further questions of Ms. Tanner? Kristen, I thank you very much for your testimony. And now we'd like to go to Grace Oakley, please.
Okay. I had signed up to testify. I may need to be available if there were any questions that you wanted to direct my way. And I'll pick up on this last one here. I believe that there are in the fine print of the law of the Interstate Land Sales Practices Act, there are a number of things where if there's a building on a lot or something like that, it doesn't have to be done through a licensee. That law was put in place for the large subdivisions of vacant lots that were being marketed as oceanfront lots in Arizona or wonderful places to go in that were really swampland in Florida or something like that. And as you mentioned, they were the type of thing that was by a general development corporation, and it was an attempt to keep people from being taken unfair advantage of. It was a consumer protection bill to keep people from being hoodwinked by the fast-talking promoters of those kinds of properties.
One other thing that I would like to mention that was touched on briefly by Captain Reardon with regard to the use of the term designee, and I know we haven't had a chance to discuss this very much, but the reference on page 2, line 15, is much broader than just having to do with testing. It says the commission may assign or designate, and we would say designate to department employees the ability to issue licenses and endorsements, to certify courses under this chapter, to approve instructors, to negotiate the terms of a repayment when somebody has to pay back a surety claim and wants to do it on an installment contract. Those kinds of things are all encompassed in there. It's not restricted to the testing service employees. And the one on page
14, line 24, that does refer specifically to the testing service, says at the beginning, if the commission authorizes the department to contract with the National Testing Service, then they can delegate that this designated person shall review the examination or approve its content. And so I would like to urge you to take another look at that language with regard to the designee, because it could, from a personnel standpoint, create or present some potential problems with regard to people who are not employees of the state being designated to do certain tasks. And that's all that I have. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them now or find the answers for you.
Well, Ms. Oka, I would just say on this last matter about the designee, if you could make a recommendation to the committee about that to clear that whole thing up.
Sure. Because, I'll be glad to address each one.
There seems to be a difference of effect. It may apply in one area but not another. And if that's the case, it's something that you as the executive secretary should be comfortable with. So we would like to make sure that's the case. Representative Ryan, do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I have a problem with the, I don't know if it's just the organization that's been hired by the Real Estate Commission to administer the desk. I spent a lot of time as a training officer in aviation. And one of the basic concepts of testing is to sample knowledge of the individuals whom you're testing to see how comprehensive it is of the subject being examined, and what it will take to bring their proficiency up to 100%. Yet this organization will tell you either you passed or you failed. They will not tell you what areas that you need for further study. And if you successfully pass one portion of the test, either the national or the Alaska State, and you fail another, you have to come back and retake both portions again. You've already demonstrated competency in one, but you are forced to come back and do the whole thing over again. And I don't see what purpose this particular requirement serves other than to keep people out of the discipline. And if that's the intention of the Real Estate Commission and the intention of these statutes, and it can be justified, I'll be happy to support it. But if it's if you're really trying to ascertain if this person has reached a level of competency that can allow them to perform the functions in a reasonably logical manner, then we should be willing to tell them what areas they were found deficient so they can go further study and get their remedial education to bring their knowledge up to the standard we want. And asking a person to perform successfully again once they've already demonstrated they can perform successfully is, I would like a justification for that. Whoever made that decision, I would like them to tell me what they're accomplishing by making a person demonstrate proficiency twice. It seems to me, and it's only my personal opinion, that those particular things were set up to keep people from entering this profession or to make it extremely difficult. And I find that to be very unsettling and very unfair, and I don't think that we should grant people powers to do that sort of thing. Thank you.
Ms. Oakley, if you care to comment on it, you don't have to, Bill.
As far as when a person passes the test, it's true. You get just the word pass and not an indication of what your grade was in terms of passing. But if you fail, there is a bar graph on the score report form that shows the areas that you were found that you did well in and the ones that you didn't do so well. You didn't do well enough in. As far as the having to take the whole thing over again, the reason that the commission has held that requirement of having to retake the whole test if you failed one portion of it and passed the other is because of the compliance with the doing it within 6 months. If we would have two different timelines going, and that would lead to a great many more problems getting the application in within the 6 months of the passing the exam. And that's just a call that the commission has made. It's something that could be, I suppose, looked at again, but that's what has been in place for more than the 10 years that I have worked for the commission.
Ms. Oakley, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ryan.
Ms. Oakley, I don't recall getting a failing grade so that they had some idea of what their level of incompetency was.
If the score is a failing one, they say what your score is.
Pardon me?
If the score is below 75, they give the score to the person.
Did this happen in the last couple of years?
It's happened for as long as I have been here, and certainly the whole time that we have been with ASI as a testing service.
Oh, well.
You don't hear a lot about this because a lot of people don't admit that they failed the examination.
Well, I failed the first time, and I took it over a couple of days later and passed it, but I was not given a score on my failure portion of where I didn't come in. I was just told I failed, and I'd have to retake the test. I passed one, I failed the other. And I found that, it kind of bothered me. And I don't remember a bar graph showing me where I was defective. Perhaps you may check and see if they're still doing what you believe they're doing.
I will be happy to.
Representative Cadre.
Yes, Grace, I'd like to we're running late here, but get your views, the concerns I talked about earlier of being maybe a family situation, and also executors. Sometimes executors get situations and they make the choice of what to do about estate taxes and what to dispose of and things like this, and maybe I think they should have the freedom to do it the way they want to do it. If they was chosen the executor to start with, they had some level of trust with it. So anyway, I'm getting back to the family situation, and I'd just like to get that cleared up.
Regard to a person acting as a receiver, trustee, administrator, executor, or guardian, that's already in one of the exceptions listed on page 30. And as far as the family member exemption, that one is one that I think the task force spent a lot of time and probably a lot of rationale, both pro and con, on whether family members should be able to step in and do without having the benefit of a license. And I have to say, I can see both the pros and the cons of that too, but if we are to look at the ultimate mission of the Real Estate Commission being that of protecting the consuming public as opposed to looking out for the benefit of the licensee, basically a consumer protection bit that we have licensing for in the first place. And so the vast majority of the family use that you are talking about, I think the vast majority of those instances would come within the exception of the four units or less, and that was one of the main reasons that they established that level of exception in the proposed bill. Beyond that, it is certainly arguable, but it was the feeling of the task force that did need to be licensed activity simply because of the number of tenants involved and the amount of money collected in security deposits. And when you look at if you think about the numbers that I gave you last Friday of dollars that we have paid out on surety claims where there were security deposits that had evaporated and not gotten to where they really belonged, that was an overriding concern and the reason that they felt that anything more than four units did need to have the protection that is afforded through the surety fund that a licensed real estate agent has as a recourse to their clients.
Well, Grace, if I could interject right now, Ms. Oakley, if you could provide the committee with any of the minutes from the task force on that particular topic, particularly as it relates to management of properties within the family or of family members and the like, that whole generic area. We would greatly appreciate it.
I'll see what I can find.
Plus, I would just put you on notice. I think you can understand from the tenor of the hearings we've had so far that even though that is existing statute in large part, we want to take a hard look at that and look at that whole section of the exceptions. Also, I'd be kind of curious now about looking at the term as a vocation. It's on page 31, line 31. What that really means, I think it's in the existing statute, and it's reenacted as that, as a vocation or for compensation.
That's all within the bit of whether there should be an exemption for corporations or not.
Right. Okay, Representative Cotter.
No, I don't have anything.
Does the staff have any other things you want to pass on to, okay. We're good. I want to thank everybody for coming today and presenting testimony on this particular bill. We will be, as I've indicated, taking under advisement the comments made today and the other day, and also any further comments on the part of any individuals or organizations that would be affected by this bill. We'd be appreciative of hearing from any of those groups or individuals. We will be issuing a committee substitute as soon as we can get it put together and drafted. I would suspect it will be near the end of the week. We'll certainly try to get it before the Alaska Association meeting on Friday. And if not, we'll get you something up there on that one. And we will be scheduling further deliberations on this bill on Monday, March 24th. With that, and also I would ask, is there anybody that is on the teleconferences that we didn't call on wishes to testify today? Well, hearing none, I wish to thank everybody for the testimony this afternoon.
I do have one question.
Okay.
What time on the 24th? Will it be at 3:15 again?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you very much, everyone. And with that, the Labor and Commerce Committee is adjourned at 5:37.